Welcome to The Cherry Picker, the horror movie podcast where we like to kill people, but not really. I'm your host, Zach Cherry, and with me as always is...
Susie. Sarah. I once read that names which begin with the letter S are the names of six. Eddie of Edward is Truth. Hi.
Jesus Christ. How did I know you would do an Olga line as well?
It was either that or a Jessica Harper line, and I feel like I'm going to do Susie Banyan the whole pod.
I feel like that would have only worked if your name started with an S.
Well,
but here we are. We're doing a movie that starts with S. We're doing Suspiria.
There you go.
Suspiria,
the
original, released February 1st, 1977. That makes this 45 years old, if my math is...
2 years older than me, so yeah.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
Way to show your hand there. But...
Or my age, which is fine.
Yeah. But you can tell your age with your hand. Isn't there something with lines? Or am I thinking like a tree?
I think you're thinking like if I cut my hand off and you count the rings.
Well, no, I wasn't thinking morbid, but more so just like hand.
If I go to a fortune teller, they can like look at the lines in my hand and just count them and just be like, 43. There
Maybe.
You go.
That's not a great you. Fortune.
No, yeah. I don't think that's true. I think I have just as many lines in my hand now as I did when I was in grade school, actually, except for maybe a crease or two. I don't know. I didn't take pictures of my palms when I was in grade school, so I can't.
I probably have more because mine are all like cracked and callousy because I don't put enough moisturizer on and I like do deadlifts and stuff at the gym, so it's not good for it. But anyway, we're talking about a movie here, and I'm sure most people, if you haven't seen Suspiria, you're at least familiar with it because this is quite a well-known foreign
title.
Horror movie. I mean, it's just of Dario Argento movies. That's who directed it. This is his most widely available, I guess, or just like most like commercially available in the U.S. or North America. And we already did Tenebrae as an episode a while back, so we're doing Suspiria now. do you want to lead us in with a premise, because some people might not know?
Sure.
Yeah.
Young American Susie Banyan travels to Germany to perfect her ballet skills at the Tanz Dance Academy. Arriving in the pouring rain and refused admission after another young woman is seen fleeing the school. Susie returns the next morning to learn that the young woman she saw rushing away has been found dead. As Susie becomes ill and the school becomes infested with maggots, a bit of research indicates that Susie has wandered into a ballet school that was once a witch's coven and still is. Suspiria. I don't know how to work the title in, like, because nobody ever says Suspiria in the movie, do they?
No.
It's not like Tenebrae.
No. Well, Suspiria is, because it's named for the mother, the head witch.
Yeah.
Mater Suspiriorum. And I don't know they might reference it in the movie. I know they do for sure, like they do in the sequel, Inferno.
Right, but at length.
I couldn't remember if they did, because they just call her Helena Marcos in this.
Right.
As far as I know. Or the directress. Absolutely. I like that title.
Yes.
The directress. It just sounds more, there's more mystique to it. But
either way.
Yeah. No, that was a very good Jessica Harper, Susie Banyan impression. She does have that kind of like, just really checked out. It's just interesting that she plays most of this movie kind of tired and in bed, because that's the energy that she gives off in it.
There's also a great deal of scenes that she shares with other actresses who are dubbed. So she has to dub as well because they can't just kind of cancel out her, cancel out the other actress's sound and then just, you know, boot hers up and then take it right back. Like she, so in order for, in the entrance of consistency or continuity rather, sound continuity, they have to have her dub many of her scenes when she's not dealing with English speaking, predominantly English speaking actors. And I think that also lends itself to being able to not have to necessarily project because you are, your mouth is right there in the microphone. So you can, you can just kind of, you know, be conversational and drift off. Like
she that. Could do the what's it called, the ASMR.
She could like not the creepy. I mean, I don't think it's creepy. I love ASMR, but I played a bit for my mother and my sister. My sister was the one who actually introduced me to this film, but and then I introduced her to ASMR. And but no, I played some whispery ASMR, and they both were like recoiling with horror, that like going like, oh my god, that's so disgusting. It's like somebody's in my ear. Stop it, stop it. And I was like, okay, fine. What about this? And then just be some people talking more like Susie Bannion, just sitting there, just kind of softly talking about their book collection or you know, their Blu-ray collection and their favorite horror movies. And they'd be like, oh, that's nice. That's soothing. But some people can't handle the whisper. And I don't know, sometimes I need the whisper to fall asleep, but that's just a little inside baseball, or inside my life. It's, yeah, I think Jessica Harper, I don't know what she's done since the remake, the Suspiria remake. But
which was like
I think
cameo.
She should get her own YouTube channel. I mean, I think it's more significant than a cameo. But cameo. Oh, stop. We'll discuss. We'll argue over that point when we talk about that movie. But but I wish she'd have a YouTube channel where she just does ASMR. Oh my god, that'd be delightful. Just sitting there and just listening to her discuss her illustrious career in horror and genre films. I want to hear, I want her to do a commentary track for every movie that she's done actually now. Phantom of the Paradise and what's the Rocky Horror Picture Show sequel that she was in where she played Janet?
I have no idea. You're asking the wrong person.
Shit. Yeah, I knew it while I was watching Suspiria. It occurred to me, but I can't think straight right now.
So you said that your sister introduced you to the film?
Yeah, I believe it was around the year 2000 or so when she was actually getting much more exposure to films than I was. I mean, yeah. I've said before I was moving in another direction, but even with horror, I was kind of releasing my grip, and she would kind of bring me back even with like a classic like this, but I had never heard of it before. I remember seeing the DVDs were abound, so that's how I know it was like 2000 or around there, because there were no Blu-rays yet. But
well, all I was going to say the double is disc. That
yeah,
yeah. No, we have a similar situation because my sister introduced me to Suspiria and Dario Argento as well, probably around the same time, because she was into all those movies and like lots of other movies too. Like she got me into like the old like Russ Meyer movies, like not horror.
Oh,
but, like,
my god!
Like Faster Pussycat Kill Kill, which I love.
Yeah,
and all that cult shit. So. I do
Beyond the
owe
Valley
a lot
of the Dolls.
Oh, I love that. But yeah, I do.
It's so
owe,
great.
Yeah, I do owe a lot of my fandom to my sister. So thanks, Melanie. But I.
You want to do an entire other vocal register to thank your sister? I think that's great.
Thanks.
I'll just send mine a text.
That's kind of you. But okay, just to kind of show your hand here, your movie loving hand, not the other one. Like what's your take on Suspiria? Love it.
Like
it.
Yeah, okay. As far as that, thumbs up in a big way. Yeah. Love it. Absolutely love it. It's the only Argento I own and watch with somewhat regularity. Again, it came in my life late enough that I didn't overwatch it, and I never want to. So I just kind of you know, watch it when it occurs to me. And I still, you know, get things. I always forget Joan Bennett is in this movie. So every time I see her, I'm just like, oh my gosh, it's Elizabeth Collins from Dark Shadows. And, yeah. But I mean,
what does she funny. Say when we first meet her? She's, cause she has this whole thing and she's just like, oh, I simply can't, like, blah, 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 like, just like super proper. And then she's just like, anyway, like, I've got to go. But she says something I would, like, had to put on the subtitles. It was, like, French, I think. It's like,
I don't retain French.
She was speaking to the police, the investigators, and she's just like, yes. Oh, she does sort of this, like, sachet, like, she starts to, and she's just like, okay, like, I got to go.
Yes. Voulez-vous coucher avec moi? But she didn't say that, but... Yeah. But I adore her because she basically does in this movie what she did on Dark Shadows, which is basically stand there with her hands clasped and act proper and talk, like, you know, kind of at length.
She had like bitch energy. Like she, you know, she presented very like polite, but you could just tell, like, you know, when we see her at the end, when she has the whole thing, like, that bitch of an American girl, like, must die, or whatever the line is. It's just like, that's who you are. I knew it was you the whole time. I like to call her... committed.
Like, she means it.
Well, her name is Madame Blank. I like to call her Madame Stank. That's just the name I gave her while we did this. Because she just has that, like, never. That, like, stank face. Like, she's just like, you know...
All right, stink face.
I mean, like, all the women characters in this movie, because I mean, like, it is predominantly women who take up the screen time here, and they're all just like, each one of them is so interesting and diverse. Because you also have Miss Tanner, who is like this sort of, like, she's almost like Nazi-esque. In her, in her wardrobe, her appearance, her manner,
severe.
But yeah, I kind of wanted to ask you about that because this does take place in Germany. Do you did you notice like maybe some of like the correlations to Nazi Germany throughout? Because there are some sets, or just not sets, but like locations that they used that were actually prominent locations during Hitler's regime, like that, the whole like square where Daniel is killed by his dog, like that was like, there were like Nazi rallies that were held there, and even like the tavern where he came from right before that was where like Hitler gave one of his like first speeches way back when.
Right. Yeah. No, none of that jumped out at me, because I think there was only a handful of scenes that, though I know this film was kind of like equally shot in Germany and Italy, maybe a little more in Germany than Italy, and maybe when in Italy it's mostly studio, shooting. I think it's just
the exteriors were Germany, like all of the interiors were in Rome.
Right. The only thing that felt kind of German was actually an interior. It's when Daniel, prior to the scene that you just referenced, is just sitting in this giant pub with the beautiful glass windows, you know, behind the stained windows behind him, and the dancing on the table and whatnot. and what is a very somber scene, even though it's kind of like explosive and vivacious, it has a distinctly German feel, or what I perceive. I mean, I've never been to Germany. I've never been to Italy. So I have a secondhand notion of these places and how they look and how they should feel at best, you know? So, interestingly enough, I was shocked to see, because I don't remember if I ever looked up the locations before, to see so much of it shot in Germany, because so much of it is still through that Argento lens that I was convinced they just substituted much of Italy for Germany. It just looked very Italian to me. So I just have a very untrained eye.
Well, that's because like usually with Argento, because I mean, like all of his movies are pretty much shot in Italy, mostly Rome. And he always finds, like, and we talked about this with Tenebrae, different locations in each movie that it's like Rome never looks the same. Like none of his movies look the same. It just in terms of the setting of like what city it takes place in. And there's even a scene, and this is shot in Germany. It's when they're at the, like later on with Udo Kier, when she goes to talk to him and they're outside of this building. And it really, like, that whole scene looked so much like Tenebrae to me. Like, it looked like that kind of more modernistic, like almost like we're in the future now, or just like the future for the, right. for like the, that time, like the 70s, 80s. And I even noticed like the color palette too, because there was Udo Kier's wearing this green jacket, which I'm pretty sure is like a similar color that we see Tilda wearing in Tenebrae at the beginning when they're like at the airport. Right. So I'm just like, oh, okay, like this, like I can see where like he made the connection where he started to like go more into that. But all I could think is like, you could probably like intercut this scene with like the John Saxon scene in Tenebrae and just like some random person's just got stabbed in like the middle of the day in this big open public space.
Yeah, I definitely got that. Was another scene actually where I felt like, okay, this looks like Germany to me, you know, like this looks, it looks like even it's like kind of like take on the modern, like feels very kind of that region of Europe as far as, you know, my limited exposure to it with Professor Milius and Dr. Mandel. But and maybe it was also just Udo Kier's presence. I feel like everything that he's around just kind of by osmosis will feel inherently more German just because of the vibes he gives off. He's so kind of like undeniably, you know, German, or maybe some other kind of like generic but Eastern European.
Yeah, but he's dubbed here too.
Right. No, I but I mean, just his look. I mean, it feels so distinct. But, okay. Yeah, so I mean, again, like I said, I was shocked at how much of it was shot in Germany because this whole time just thought it was Italy sitting in like Italian thing. Cause even that scene with Daniel when he gets like attacked by the dogs, I was looking at the columns on that building, like, you know, with the like the very, very steep stairs leading up to them, and thought like, oh, if somebody told me that was Italian, it would look so incredibly Italian, like, you know, like the entrance to the Colosseum or something like that. Mm-hmm. But so don't look to me as an authority on
I won't specific
architecture.
But I mean, like, yeah, because all of the interiors, like the whole school, that was shot on a set, because I mean you could tell, because really like this the building, like the interiors are impossible. It's like the Overlook Hotel where even like the entrance way like the way it's kind of shaped, it's like this kind of like round room, and there's like the staircase that goes up the side and there's windows, but we can see from the facade of the building that like there wouldn't be any outer walls where that is. But even where anything goes in this building, like nothing makes sense. And like, as we go through the movie, even at the end, when she's making her exit out, it's just like, where is everything in relation to everything? It's just like the whole concept of like, oh, follow the footsteps, and it's just like, to where, you know, like,
even the fact that she can tell. There's a part of me that like wonders, like, if I were in a room and I were hearing footsteps outside of it, would I be able to tell if I were that far away from like where they're walking away from the room, and that if they were turning left or right?
Noise bounces. I have noisy neighbors all around me, and I will hear something like below me. I'm on like the top floor and it sounds like it's above me. Mm-hmm. So I don't trust footstep sounds at all.
Well, it's also disorienting. I mean, much like the world that Susie Banyan is like introduced. I mean, from the get-go, one thing that I had forgotten was how it's almost a trick that Argento does with the score when it's first being introduced. I forgot that it pops in as she's like, you know, like walking, making her way out of the airport. Mm. And then it pops out when we get back to her, almost like, did I really just hear that? Yeah. And then as she makes her way finally outside and breaks through the doors and the thunder and the lightning is just like, okay. It goes full on, almost like it's almost like it's occurring to her, like, I think I'm walking into something. Like, I'm getting, or as she would say, I think I'm walking into something. But she, I also had to wonder, like, she asks the driver about how, if it's been raining, because obviously it's thundering and lightning, like, so heavily, you can barely see, like, the road ahead of you and everything like that. I almost had to wonder, like, did she bring the rain with her? Or is this something that the witches are doing? Or is it a little column A, a little column B? Like, didn't he say it's only been going for like a half hour and she just kind of smirks at him?
I mean, if anything, I would think that it's more just a coincidence. But if it had to be one, I would say it's more to do with the witches, because they're kind of like, they're, you know, about to kill someone. Maybe that's sort of the thing. Because it rains again at the end of the movie, and that's when they're planning on killing her. But it doesn't rain before they get Sarah or Daniel. So that's
or an inconsistent else,
theory. But fuck that cab driver. These guys clearly don't work off of chips. I love how he's so impatient. Well, he's really the nicest cab driver that she could have had, because all the others like almost run her over or just like veer past her. But he like stops and she's like, "Will you help me with my bags?" And he's just kind of like waving it, like, come on, we've got places to be here. But I love how she gets into the cab. Like, well, first she's kind of she's like, you know, where to? Just like Escherstrasse or whatever, which is interesting because like Escher, like the abstract, like the staircase, sort of like that artist who, you know, does all the things with like the upside down staircases, which is on the mural there. So that could be a thing, because that's like going back to the impossible interiors.
Spaces.
That could be like a reference to that. But I love how he's like, oh, Escherstrasse. Like, it's just like, that's what she fucking said.
I know.
But no. Yeah, and then she's like, has it been raining long? And he just like looks back and gives her like this, like he just leers at her and like long pause. Mm-hmm. And then what you said, like 30 minutes. Like,
yes.
like, fuck this guy.
Right.
But yeah.
And then he drives her through a series of trees that I am convinced
the Black Forest
Tim Burton stole. Yeah, that I'm convinced Tim Burton stole just the look of those trees for his Batman movie, when the Batmobile is first driving like Kim Basinger or Vicki Vale, whatever, you know, like and everything. And she's like, where are we going? And everybody knows it's the Batcave. But I always think about
Batman
first.
I was always more attached to Batman Returns. That was my Batman. And it still is my Batman movie. Like, fuck that.
As is it mine,
but Nolan shit, you know.
I didn't know Batman Returns was on the way when I watched the first Batman over and over and over again.
Oh, so fair enough.
It was my Batman movie until I got Batman Returns.
I
concur.
Yeah,
but
and you know what? Like, just sorry to go off on this Batman tangent, but like similar to this movie, Batman Returns is just like a lot of like really, like, beautiful nonsense. Like, there's really no plot at all to either of these movies, but they just like, they're just a lot of fun and they look good, you know?
Yeah, with a kind of like schizophrenic background. or frenetic, for lack of a better term. Like, just like strange fever dream chaos always kind of drifting behind you, and you can't really make sense out of things. But at the same time, this is a movie that I think we've had movies that we've disagreed on in the past where I'm looking for logic in something that probably doesn't warrant that kind of you know, movie going. And with this one, maybe because it's so aesthetically pleasant, but also just because I'm so it's so easy to kind of like follow the actors. Every one of the actors on screen either has an incredibly distinct look that I just find captivating, or a distinct presence, the way they disturb the air and move through environments, that I find absolutely compelling and magnetic. Especially Jessica Harper. There's something about her look that is so uncharacteristic of I guess, a typical American ingenue, especially at that time of the release of this movie. She's so undeniably singular and unique. I can't stop watching
her. Big eyes and and like a very unique
no makeup.
Eyebrow.
Very, very round skull. And again, just a dreamy quality, the way she just kind of, you know, speculates about things and looks skyward when she's
she looks like a living doll almost.
She does. Yeah. She absolutely does.
Yeah. Well, this like the movie, actually, first to just touch upon what you said about logic. I'm like the logic person here. Like if something doesn't make sense, I'm the first one to like jump off and just be like, nope, fuck that. But I think like I watched it today. And I've seen it many times. And I watched it like recently before this too, because I got the 4K earlier this year. Looks stunning in 4K, by the way, just to be a 4K snob for a second there. But I was, I think I was like really watching it from a certain perspective, because I was watching the special features first, and there was an interview with the actress who plays Olga, and she was like, because we've talked about this before, we did the old podcast and we talked about Suspiria, but it was just like, is Olga in on it? And I watched this interview with her, because I don't think I've ever seen it before, and she basically said like, oh yeah, she was totally in on it. Like, I guess she had like discussions with Argento, and they're just like, yeah, you're gathering information for the coven. And as soon as I, you know, watched it through with that perspective, everything really did, like the little threads of logic that there were like made a lot of sense, because I was just like, okay, so that's why, because she's like tells her about like, oh, when I saw Pat when she was leaving, I heard her say the words secret and flowers or irises. And she's like, oh, that's interesting. Like, yeah, you wouldn't want to talk to her. Like, she'd find out, she'd be the one to find out real easy if you got into a jam or something. So she was just basically projecting like who she was, but then like took that information and immediately told Madame Stank. And then that's why they're like, okay, well, we got to keep an eye on her because she's going to blow our cover. Or a coven, and that's, and then, and like, because immediately after that, that's when she gets the, like, the shining light, and she gets sick, but then all that shit happens with Albert, the nephew, you know, it's just like, it's like, the dog took a piece out of his arm, is what it sounds like she said, but I always saw that, like, because I'm like, why did they kill Daniel? Is it just because they're really petty, which they probably are? But then, like, as he was leaving, he was saying, it's just like, you, like, I hear things, like, I might be blind, but like, you know, I know what goes on around here. And he's like, ah, fresh air. But I'm just that. Like, okay, so they took him out because like he was another person that like could have known, and then
another liability.
And then they were like, it was after she had the conversation with Madame Stank that she said the same thing about the irises. And she's like, well, you've done really good. I don't know what secret or irises means myself, but I'm going to tell the detective. And then like immediately after that, that's when you see like they're in the pool, and it's almost like someone spying on them as like the camera goes down. So just like there is logic to like the sequence of actions that happens in the movie, which I think I'd never really paid that close attention to in the past, because I'm just like, oh, look at all the pretty colors and the sound and all that. So,
but I mean, even in terms of like the way they, I mean, Joan Bennett's character, Madame Stank, as you call her, I can't hear you call her that without imagining her and thinking, oh my God, she must smell bad. But it's not fair. But
Stank face.
Her.
Yeah.
Stink face.
Stank.
Stank. Now she's stink face. But God, poor Joan Bennett. R.I.P. Anyway. She makes a remark as she's descending the staircase after, I believe, Sarah disappears.
Yeah.
And talks about, like, you know, I'm the one who has to deal with their families. I'm the one who has to answer the questions of their parents. And I love the way she talks, too.
Yeah.
But it just made me think, like, well, what about everyone's parents? Like, if you're just, like, killing girls or making them disappear and whatnot, like, what about... Yeah. I mean, Daniel obviously had no one because he's sitting alone in a pub. His dog can't even be there, his only confidant to, like, commiserate with. And he has to be, like, probably tied up outside while he just gets hammered, or at least a little buzz on, and then he goes out. So obviously he has no one who's gonna, like, miss him. But, like, the girls whose families are sending them to Europe, do they just really, do they corner the market with girls, or do they put some kind of glamour over the girl? I mean, this is where the logic, like, yeah, could kick in if I wanted to, like, decipher, like, well, it's a flawed structure, but I don't care. The movie's too much fun for me.
Well, because there's even a line, like, when Susie first arrived, or, like, the second day when she, like, finally comes in, and they're like, we were expecting you last night, but then she says, like, oh, I know your aunt, or, like, you know, go way back with her. So there's, like, a connection there. So I'm just like, is the aunt maybe a witch as well?
Right.
Because there is theories that Susie is also a witch, but she's a good witch. Mostly because at the end of
her.
At the end of the movie, as she's leaving, like, things are exploding. Like, they're not exploding because of what's happening. They're exploding as she's going through them. It's almost like she's... Right. Paving the way to her exit to safety. Otherwise, she would have, like, also perished in the structure as it burned down. But
She's like Carrie White the first 20 minutes of Carrie. Like, she hasn't honed her skill. She hasn't. I mean, I've heard that somewhat recently, and in my subsequent viewings, I find it actually more entertaining to believe that she is, because, like I said earlier, it makes me wonder, like, so did it start raining, like, when she entered the same atmosphere as this coven, and the world is just kind of, like, you know, brewing, like, you know, this discord, like, you know, like she brought one element and they brought another, and then it just smashed together and then rain. But, and because of that reason, because I do notice, like, you know, the doors are opening, and even though it's chaos, nothing seems to be hurting her. And then all of a sudden it just erupts into flames once she's out of the vicinity. So, and we hear the screams of the coven. So that's very Carrie White to me as well. But
something about, like, horror movies from the 70s where they just, like, we're just going to end with chaos and destruction and flames.
Yeah, go out with a bang.
I was going to say, the movie, like, originally it was supposed to be, like, young girls. Like, they're all supposed to be, like, 11, 12, 13 years old. And I guess the producers were just like, absolutely not. Like, we're not going to make a horror movie centered or, like, killing young girls. They eventually kind of, or, like, Dario Argento, like, sort of did that with the Phenomena years later, but I guess, like, the trade-off, or, like, how he was able to retain the imagery of, like, making it seem like they were younger girls was by putting the doorknobs on all the doors, like, way high, so it made them seem shorter than they actually were.
I mean, I just thought it was European because I'm an ignorant American. But I mean, that would have been amazing to see, like, all of this happen to little girls. I mean, we wouldn't have gotten Jessica Harper or any of the incredible performances that we got. And also, actually, I kind of enjoy that these are, like, kind of, like, still kind of girls, but on the brink of womanhood, as it were, because it makes me, it makes me appreciate more kind of, like, aesthetic choices they make. Like, when we're first introduced to Olga, for instance, she's got a very kind of, like, not unkempt, but just, you know, like, unmanicured look. Like, her hair is just loose and hanging, and she's just kind of, like, running around, you know, being, you know, this kind of typical young girl. And then the next time we see her in the apartment with Susie, she's got this whacked out kind of Princess Leia-esque, you know, hairdo that I can't even figure out where the hair is coming from and where it's going.
Yeah.
And she's also dressed to the nines like she's suddenly Gloria Swanson or somebody, you know, like some kind of like screen siren who's, you know, like at her, in her like mansion, you know, like hosting, you know, like over cocktails or something. And I'm
just
like,
and that wallpaper. Is, that wallpaper.
Oh my god, gorgeous. So of course she's in on it because apparently like she's getting all her bling and all of like
yeah,
her
really, she gets really to beautiful she gets digs. To live off campus. You know, she just feeds the coven information. I don't think she's actually a witch. She's just kind of like doing their bidding for them.
She's their Renfield.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, why not? Do you think Mark is in league with it,
see,
too?
That's,
for the first time ever, I actually thought he was.
I don't think he was, but it's just like... Because the only thing that would seem to suggest that is when... like, after Sarah is killed and then Susie comes in and she's just like, where'd she go? And Miss Tanner's just like... She took off like a thief in the night. And they're just like, wasn't that right, Mark? and he's like, oh, yes. I heard her... leave. And like, no, I think that she, because like, remember earlier on there, like, you know, we see that he's doing all the grunt work because he never has any money, and
yes,
and that's why that bitch Tanner's got him doing a thousand and one different things. So she probably just threatened him. It's just like, you're gonna lie to Susie, because if you don't, then you're gonna get kicked out of the school. And it was easy as that. Like, he, like, that's the thing. Like, the men in this movie are meek and pathetic, and you know, they can get pushed around by these great, powerful women. So, of course, he doesn't work for them. He's just, you know, he's probably completely ignorant to what he was even lying about, but, you know, he was afraid to get kicked out of school. That's my take on
it.
Really? Yeah.
I mean, I also wondered, like, if there's a possibility. I mean, that's another thing I love about this, is you can dig and dig and dig and speculate. And because another thing I was wondering is, like, well, they are witches. Like, what if he's under some kind of thrall or something where he's just kind of, like, agreeable? It's almost like if they gave him some kind of spell lobotomy equivalent, where he's only – he only knows as much as they need him to from time to time. And maybe Madame – I don't even see, this is the thing. I don't even like calling her Madame Blank, even though everybody in the movie like pronounces it that way. It feels so ugly and American. Yeah.
That's why I say Madame Stank.
I don't imagine her name is ugly and American. I just imagine that like Madame Blanc. I like, and that's how they pronounced it in the remake. So that's another point for the remake for me. But
do you like the remake?
Well, I mean, like, not better. I just like it for completely different reasons.
Yeah.
And we can go into those whenever we discuss it. But with this one, another, because I mean, I feel like there's maybe less to speculate about for better for that movie. But with this movie, I love how much I can speculate and kind of fill in the blanks and wonder about, like, well, is Mark in line? I mean, he could be in a thrall. He could be he could be a Renfield too. But also, then I think of someone like Pavlos, and I feel like Pavlos is just kind of an ideal. fit for them, because I think he is just weak-minded on his own and therefore kind of obedient.
Yeah.
And also something that can arouse more suspicion than they do, because he is so strange that him just milling about the way he is might put most people off. It's another thing that makes me absolutely love Susie as much as I do, because she seems to kind of like get used to him really quickly. I love that she's just got her arms crossed at one point. It's like, oh, Pavlos, how many times must I eat this way? You know, something like that. And she's talking to him like they're buds, you know, like, hi, Pavlos, how's your day going?
Well, and they're like, answer, but yeah, because he doesn't speak English, he doesn't understand it, and Miss Tanner's like insulting him to his face, just being like, right. Look at him, isn't he so ugly?
Yes!
I get, like, from him, I get more of a sense, like, he's like the lurch type, like, he's just like the servant, totally. Like, just like,
oh, that's why I love him,
and just like, you know, he'll do whatever they need him to. That's the thing, like, because this coven, I mean, just like to talk about like the powers, because they're all derived from the Black Queen or whatever they call her, the Helena Marcos. Because the idea is that the coven is only as powerful as its head, as its leader. So it's like you cut off the head of the leader, they lose their power. And that's essentially what we see at the end. Totally. So really, like, all this... Yeah, like, everything, like, all the... these hench people, that's it. There's just like everyone is like a hench man or woman or you know, hench person, we'll call them, like doing sure. the bidding for Helena Marcos. And so just like, you know, I think that you have to be willing enough to submit to the coven to be a member of it. I don't think that they would just put like a spell on someone to just be like, you're one of us now. Because that does. I mean, they might recruit people. Maybe that's what they're doing. Like, they're recruiting girls. If that's kind of like what the cover is of like the dance school, that they're just kind of like assessing the students and just being like, okay, yeah, I think that she could be, you know, one of us. Maybe that's how they got Olga. But maybe like Olga is, because even like in the interview with the actress, she was just like, well, my take on it is that I've already graduated, but I'm still just like hanging around or something. Because they even say something about that, like she's like like last year student or something, and that's why she gets to live off campus. So it's possible, and maybe that's what they had initially wanted to have with Susie, but then she was just kind of like, no, she's prying too much. Like, we feel like her energy is more of like investigative, whereas like an organization or like a coven of witches are probably more like, you know, you can't be asking questions. You have to fall in line with the leader and do what they say. So she might be a little too willful for their witchery, and that's why they're just like, we got to kill her, you know?
I'm so glad you're bringing these things up, because you're making me just kind of like, in my own mind, like justify. That's why Olga looks so kind of like, you know, a typical teenage girl in the locker room, because she needs to blend in. She needs to look young. She needs to have her hair down and just be kind of free and have a, you know, not a makeup free face, but have a face that isn't made up like her grandmother. And then like once she's in her own digs, she wants to be, you know, a woman. She wants to, to ascend. Yeah. She wants to be an adult, purveyor of the occult. I also love that it's not the occult. It's the occult. Mm-hmm. But also, I feel like Susie is such, as much as I love her, she, for a great bulk of the movie, is such a passive character also. Like, she's just kind of like wandering around having things done to her. And Sarah seems to be the one who's actually more, what's the word I'm looking for? Just, curious. I can't find a better word. and just, you know, and actually acts on it. Like, she, you know, I mean, her acting is basically kind of like leaning up in bed when she hears something. Whereas, you know, Susie, because she's also being, you know, like fed, you know, these horrible things in her food, and she's also more content to just kind of lay there and speculate without sitting up. Well, like, that's,
I love that's like the drama of it all too, because like they're just the way that this is like shot, like when they're after the whole maggot incident and they're all sleeping in the dance room and all the sheets are up, and that's when the directress Helena Marcos comes in, and you see the silhouette, and then you start to hear the snoring as she lays down. And like, also like, for anyone who's able to fall asleep that quickly, like teach me your ways. I need to know how to do that. Takes me forever to fall asleep once I like hit the pillow. But
careful what you wish for. It could be a spell.
It could be. But I just love how, because you, like you say, like Sarah like jolts up and she's like, do you hear that? And they're like zooming in. They're like whispering. And it's like, this is serious talk. Whereas like, if this was like a normal situation and it was like someone like Susie and even like Sarah, well, Sarah has like her suspicions, obviously, because she's like talked to Pat. But like, she hasn't really given any context to any of this to Susie. So she's just having this conversation. And I would think this is a conversation like, oh, hey, I think that's the directress, because like, I recognize her snore. But she's just like, that one time. And like, it's just like super like serious and secretive. And Susie's just like, what? this is incredible information. Right. Like, this is important.
Are you sure? But also, I mean, I guess maybe that's why Sarah's, because it does seem like they're kind of like assessing the whole time, like what to do with Susie, and like, well, I don't know, let's just try this, and you know, let's give her this thing, and, like, and then by the time we reach the end, like, Madame Blanc is so. I hate saying it that way, but I don't want to say Madame Blanc because she is Madame Blanc. That's what everybody calls her. Yeah. She is so fed up with just kind of like, that little pest has been a blah, 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 blah. But Sarah, they actually have no problem, like, kind of. That's another thing, is how much of this is premeditated, because they literally kind of lead her to a room that obviously was set for her. We don't know how many rooms are probably set that way. Maybe every little kind of like corridor and nook and cranny has something that's, you know, ultimately fatal waiting for her.
It was like a big slinky. That's the only thing I could
think of. I mean, I look at it and I mean, I've heard people call it barbed wire, but there's no barbs about that wire. So I just kind of, in my mind's, I've heard things alluded to as razor wire, and I'm wondering, is that what it's supposed to be? No, like, razors, wire that is literally made out of, like, I guess.
And she just gets tangled
in it. It is cutting her.
And I love the fact that she doesn't even see it before, you know, she jumps down. But I mean, like, that's okay, well, I think that, like, and this is the logic, which, you know, you have to just, like, throw to the wayside. But, like, she's in a school full of, like, other people. And, you know, they're not part of the coven. She could just, like, scream and just be like, someone's chasing me. Like, and all the students will just then coalesce in the hallway. And then the person going after her will have to, like, like slink away. But there's just so many instances.
There's a sleep spell. If there is a sleep spell for them to go to bed. Yeah. Okay, now you're asleep.
I mean, there could have also, but in that case, they could have done a spell to make everyone forget about the maggots and just go back to their beds like normal. Like,
but that makes, okay, because that brings up another, an interesting question that was, again, for the first time while I was watching the movie, for the first time I can remember, I saw the maggot scene and I wondered, do you think the maggots were, like, an oversight, like a mistake, and they just kind of started falling because, uh-oh, oops, all those dead body parts we were storing upstairs, they attracted maggots, who knew? Or do you think it was maybe planting a seed to see who, like, their spells don't work on to, like, make them kind of docile and quiet, and whoever has a strong enough will to ask questions and to speculate and to wonder, like, oh, something suspicious is going on, we'd better find out what it is, you know, like, and those are the culprits, those are the ones we need to, because for the first time I wondered, like, it seems too obvious to, like, have dead,
and like the
body
fact that
parts
it,
or meat even.
The fact that the whole maggot thing happened in, like, the first night that Susie stayed there too, it's just like, is this what it's like, every night, you know, like just show up and have, like, crazy shit happen. But I love, like, just getting back to, like, their treatment of her, I guess, like, just, like, of her sickness. Because the first time we see her in bed, Miss Tanner is, like, forcing a fucking jug of water into her mouth. It's just like, no, I don't want to drink. And she's just like, you need to drink. I can't do the Miss Tanner accent, but, like,
it's very gravelly.
What the fuck is she doing there? It's just like it's like they just needed, like, a cloth and she would have been waterboarding her, but it was it, like, that looked like torture. And then you had the doctor there the needle. So I think that maybe Miss Tanner, it's interesting that she's sort of like or at least Madame Stanks, like, number one, because, like, she is not subtle at all about any of her devious acts throughout this movie.
Well, Tanner isn't, for sure. And Madame Blanc, I feel, I'm going to keep calling her that. Madame Blanc, I feel, is also really obvious, but just kind of cordial. Like, she's like, oh, I'm very sorry. I'm very sorry that happened. It won't happen again. You have my word as a woman and a witch. Oops, did I say too much? Well, I... Okay, sarah. And she just exits the room. But also, okay, I get such a creepy energy from Professor Verdegast. I don't know. It's just like, again, I think he occupies one scene, in the movie, and the rest of the time they're just like talking about it. It's like, oh, that's what Professor Vertigas thought I needed. He said it would be best. It'd feed my blood. But he's another man who's just kind of like, I wonder, like, what is your role in this? Obviously, you're not, you know, you're up to no good. But you seem to be, I don't know, I don't like the way he touches, I was going to say just Jessica Harper, but I don't like the way he touches Susie and everything like that. Like, I'm just kind of like, stop putting your hands, creepy old man. And I don't know what you're getting out of this. And I don't want to know, actually. The more I speculate about it, the less I want to. See, he puts me off. All of the men actually put me off more so than Pavlos. Pavlos actually kind of like turns into this.
He has your heart.
To give another allusion, you already made the Lurch comparison. So I'm going to just go whole hog and say, I get this wonderful kind of like Karloff, Frankenstein's monster vibe from him. Like, yeah totally. He's imposing, and yeah, he might even be capable of, you know, violence or destructive acts and things like that. But it seems like if you're just kind of like cool around him, he might just be cool. Mm-hmm. You know, that's how I feel about Pavlos.
Here's a question. Who do you think is the one like doing the killing? Like, if it's one person or multiple people? Because like when we see at the beginning, there's that like hairy arm that comes shattering through, puts me to shame. But it's like, is that a witch? Or like, is it like Pavlos? Or like, you know, who could it be? Because we never see the face of the person. And there's like the one that goes after Sarah, we see the back of their head, and that's Dario Argento in his little cameo. But yeah, right. I just wanted to see if like you had a theory for who was doing the dirty work.
I mean, we get a glimpse. It's not spot on, but we get a glimpse of the arms of Marcos at the end, and they're not hairy per se. I think we just kind of see them. I mean, like her face, like just kind of like very, very, you know, shriveled and decomposing, and you know,
well, I think she's in
kind of like rot.
She's invisible anyway. Like, I don't.
No, but like when she falls on the floor, we get a glimpse of.
Yeah, like after I think that she only becomes visible like once she loses her power and gets stabbed. I think like all the other times she's just, that's just her thing. She's invisible.
But you don't think that that's like just what she like kind of looked like in her daily practice, that she wasn't just so old that she just kind of like was rotting like fruit? Like, that's the impression I got.
I think that she was always invisible. That's just like her thing.
But I see if she can, I mean, also it's a question of like, is it kind of like a Bram Stoker's Dracula thing where the witches can like morph and take shape, because we never actually observe it happening. Yeah. We can only speculate.
Well, we see the, like during the Daniel scene, like what looks like shadows of witches on broomsticks.
That's another thing. Like, because I wanted to ask you that too. Do you think that they are indeed on broomsticks, or that they're just kind of like hovering? Yeah. Because I don't really see brooms. I do see, it could be a broom, but it could also just be like a long caftan or something, you know, not a caftan, but you know, a cloak or something like that. Yeah. And they could just be like, you know, like riding the wind or something like that. Yeah. And also they could be something else entirely. I mean, we have that bat that Susie kills that I don't believe is just a bat. I think it's one of the witches like in bat form. And that's why it's so... You know, or it could be a minion of the Antichrist. I don't know, but I mean, that's a lot. You can't nail anything down.
Yeah.
So this is like kind of like a, you know, a largely, why can't I think of what's the painting that you look and you see, you see what you see, and it's not
Rorschach.
Shit. Rorschach. Thank you. This movie is a huge Rorschach test. In and of itself, like, you know, whatever you kind of like see happening is probably what's happening for you.
I mean, like the less shown, the more mystique, like that's probably what they were going for. That whole bat scene, like all I think of is just like, you know, she really earned that cigarette afterwards.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Even though it's a cute little puppet.
Yeah, I think that whoever was doing it, I mean, because they have the same eyes, because we see the eyes through the window at the beginning, and then we see the eyes behind Sarah later on. So, I mean, who knows? It's probably just some unseen person who's part of the coven who they send to do like the killing when they have to. But that whole that whole opening scene. Okay. Okay, we're really gonna get into it.
Yes,
I love when we say that. Pat Hingle, but Pat Hingle was it another Batman?
I know, right? Commissioner Gordon from the Burton Schumacher movies.
But I guess this is Patricia Hingle.
Yeah, whatever.
Yeah.
Maybe that's the reason Pat Hingle got cast. Maybe Burton is just a huge Suspiria fan.
Yeah, just like, you have the same name as this character. Because this goes back to, obviously we were introduced to Susie, but we have the whole, like, opening scene kill of, like, here's this character who's introduced and we're following her story, at least for, like, a big part of the opening. And then, like, oof, there they go. They're killed off.
Yes.
But I mean, like, just in terms of opening scenes of horror movies, like, this, like, where would this rank for you? Is this, like, top 5, top 10?
Oh, wow. I mean, it's one of my favorite things about the movie. Mm-hmm. So, were you with your rankings, you kids, today?
I didn't say, like, you have to rank anything. I just said, where would it fall? Or, you know, is it up there?
But that's ranking. That is literal ranking.
Well, no, because to rank, I would have to get you to then place
exactly
other things.
So, I get a top 10, okay. I guess.
I'm sorry I put you on the spot.
What about you? Do you have an answer for your own question?
Yeah, I think it's definitely, like, if someone was to ask me, like, most memorable, like, opening scenes of horror movies, like, there's Scream, Drew Barrymore, probably Halloween, this, I could probably think of others, but you could even say, like, because you could have the same correlation of, like, Janet Leigh being the character that we follow. But with Pat, I mean, it is a much quicker bit of screen time in the movie. But yeah, like, this, it is probably the most explosive part of the movie. It's the most colorful, the loudest, the most in your face, and the most violent. Because they kill her a lot. They even get the friend to. I love her manic energy. Like, the friend when she's just like, open the door. Oh. Like, she's the thing is, yes. Like, for all she knows, like, Pat could have just been like, thrashing about and just breaking shit, but she's just like, there's a murderer, help, and it's just like, you don't know that. Yes. You don't even know that there's another person there, and if there is, you don't know that they're specifically a murderer. But I loved her, like, just banging on every door. Nobody's fucking,
yeah, she's trying to get help, but what is she gonna do? Like,
but maybe they put a spell on the building. Everyone was asleep. But
there you go, exactly. But and so no matter what she screams, but yeah. Like, what's she supposed to do? Just like bang on doors and go like, I have no idea what's going on. Wake up. Nobody's going to wake up for that or get out of bed.
Yeah.
But even I don't mean to victim blame either, but I do want to ask you.
Okay. I love when you victim blame.
Yeah. No, I'm speculating. Because I mean, to a certain extent, like, okay, you can't blame someone necessarily for, like, reaching over an open flame and, you know, and for a second and they get burned. Like, ooh, I didn't realize that it was that hot or that I was that close or whatever. But it's almost like, can you blame someone if they hold their arm over the flame for an extended period of time? Almost like they're waiting to get burned. And then they get burned and go, ow, I got burned. Because for me, the Pat got burned moment is when she... The music is the beautiful music, which we haven't even really addressed
yet. Goblin, yeah. Or the Goblin. Yeah,
Goblin is just, yes, is swelling. And she's standing there with, like, you know, the rain and everything. And she's looking out the window with her lamp.
She's holding a lamp up to it. I don't know how that's working. You're just going to see a reflection of yourself.
I know. You're just reflecting your own face back at you. But it actually does make it kind of creepy because then you see things moving in the reflection and you're just kind of like, what? Oh, it's just her.
Yeah.
But she stands there and you know, but first I think kind of without the lamp or with the lamp low, and then holds the lamp even higher and then kind of tilts the lamp to expose the light even more so, face getting incredibly close to the glass. What did you think was going to happen? Yeah. Like, is there anything, if you thought anything was waiting for you outside a window,
yeah,
would you press your face up against it and, you know, just wait until something happened?
Yeah.
That's a legitimate question I'm asking you, Zach Cherry. How much money would it take for you to be told there's something out there?
Well, no.
And you go over and just press your face up against the window.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that's just the nature of that character, because like similar to Susie and, you know, even Sarah, like that, like, you know, maybe the reason why they were targeted for being so curious and willful and
sure,
just like needing to know, like needing the answers at any cost, mm-hmm, to whatever detriment to their personal safety and survival, mm-hmm, and well-being, that, you know, will risk it just to see what it is. Because yeah, she makes terrible, stupid decisions. I mean, like, even, I mean, I guess like it's probably not smart to stay in the school if you think that people are coming after you, but like running away, it probably would have been better to not like separate yourself from your friend whose like apartment you're staying at and just like hiding in there. But even like when she first goes into the bathroom and the windows burst open and she has that, she's like, huh, and the friend comes running in and she's like, hey, why don't you close it? And it's like, you see, it was just the wind. And she's like, why don't you tell me all about it? And she's like, well, you see, the wind, it like burst the windows open. It's just like, okay. Like, you had the opportunity to divulge a little bit more information and you didn't. So it's just like, it's really your own fault. You know, she could have, there's so many things she could have done. But,
so you're joining me in the victim blaming.
Yeah, and if she knew about the secret iris,
right?
You know, like, you know, she could have also gone to the belly of the beast. But
well, that was another thing that I wondered about. Like, if Susie, I wonder if Susie, the reason she could defeat Helena Marcos is because, oh, like, she's one of the only presences, particularly in that school, who could have, because if she is like this kind of benevolent power who just doesn't know it yet, like, because that's really easy. Like, Helena Marcos gets taken out super easily. Yeah. If all you got to do is go in the bedroom and just stab her in the neck, and that's it.
Yeah.
Like, I'd like, it helps me enjoy the movie even more, particularly the climax, if the reason it works and the reason why Helena Marcos is so not even worried about it is because even she doesn't realize like the power that's like standing before her. Like, she knows she's a threat, but she doesn't understand because she doesn't work. She doesn't operate with that same kind of power, that kind of, you know, like compassionate, sweet, deep voice power. And so it makes me think like that's why Susie is able to like hit her and actually hurt her.
Yeah.
Because and that's why the doors start bursting. It's like, oh my gosh, I didn't realize I had this power the whole time. But another thing, just to get
you
back
sound
to-
like Alicia Witt in
oh, like great.
Urban Legend, just another like throaty voice heroine.
Deep pull. Yeah. Yes. The Alicia Witt is definitely, oh my gosh, I never, okay, I'm gonna keep looking for actresses who speak in this particular register of their voice. Although I think Alicia Witt's a little more aggressive. I just always hear her from Cecil B. DeMented, like talking about how, oh, I don't want to go into it, but she tells a story about her family, a traumatic story about her family. Melanie Griffith starts laughing at her and she goes, you think that's funny? But anyway, so there's more gusto there in Alicia Witt. But if Jessica Witt ever got like real, I'm Jessica Witt, if look at it, I'm just confusing the two of them. If Jessica Harper ever got like legitimately angry and started shouting at someone, maybe she'd sound like Alicia Witt. But I still haven't even lived that long. But to get back to the opening sequence, in terms of like, it's, I love it for its impact, certainly. Like, just like kind of like moving through it is always a joy. It always feels like a big warm horror hug for me. But another thing that I really appreciate it on a more cerebral level, is it totally lays the groundwork for kind of what it's going to be like inhabiting the rest of this movie visually, sonically, even in terms of like the redness, like the red paint looking blood that they are using dripping down the legs of Pat Hingle. Mm-hmm. And even just, again, like once Pat moves into that other environment that, you know, apart from where all the Suspiria is going on, she, it's just like one incredible vista. Like she moves through, I think, about three rooms or so, and each one is kind of like more elaborate and beautiful than the next. And again, like it's just kind of like saying, yeah, you're going to be like, behold, you know, to a lot of this kind of like velvet wallpaper that we have going on, and a lot of this kind of like incredible intricate patterns and bright, vivid mixed primaries, you know.
Well, they used a particular technique. I'm trying to look up what it was, but it was because they had the red, blue, green sort of thing, and it was like a three color thing that they could adjust to make them more vivid, so it wouldn't disrupt the other colors that were on the screen. And that's why you would see, like, you know, the whole screen like awash in blue or red. So like I guess it's a misconception that this was shot in Technicolor. But I think it was actually like Eastman color, and it was like one of the last ones of the time. Oh, here it is. It is often assumed that to achieve the rich color palette, the film was shot using the outdated three-strip Technicolor process. This was in fact not true. No film made after the mid-1950s was shot using this method. This film was instead shot on normal Eastman color Kodak stock, then printed using the three-strip Technicolor process. Utilizing one of the last remaining three-strip machines, this issue has been confused somewhat by the fact that on the 25th anniversary documentary, discussion of the printing process by cinematographer Luciano Tavoli was followed by a diagram showing a three-strip camera. Okay. Oh. Well, there you go. That's how they achieved it. Because, I mean, like, color does not look like that in real life.
No matter how hard you... And you can't just, like, push up saturation. I mean, that's interesting, because if you just push up the saturation, then it's going to affect everything in the field and everybody's skin. The palest person is going to start to look orange or pink or, you know... I mean, everybody's white in this movie, so orange or pink. But, I also... Well, that's another thing. I laughed out loud at... when Susie is laying there sick and Madame Blanc makes the remark, you've even got color back in your cheeks. And she's like laying in like fully awash in red. And I'm just like, she does have color back in her cheeks, because she's just got this severe, like, it looks like she's developing photos in her room, you know? Like, so that made me happy. I want to go in, because we've touched on it, but I really want to go in on the Daniel murder, because I have to say it's already hard to stomach, because I like Daniel. I like everything about him. I respect his kind of like protective impulse when he's being told that his dog mauled little Albert and everything. Mm-hmm. I love the way he has this Tanner just like going at him, and he just it hits right back, and he has every reason in the world to feel completely vulnerable at that moment, but he's still kind of you know, on his way out. So I respect the man, and also I feel for him because of the aforementioned loneliness. You know, he has no friends in a pub that is the liveliest, you know, venue yet. And then for him to walk back and like have all of this shit going on, and for him to not understand, and then to be attacked by his own dog. The only presence on that screen that I feel even more sympathy for than Daniel is his dog. Like, I worry so much about the fate of that dog. Even if the dog only lives, because usually when dogs attack people, they don't let them live for very long, especially if they find out that it's
when,
like a wolf mix.
One police went to check on Daniel, and the other kept running after the dog. Right. But I think that's the pettiness of the coven, because they're just like, well, this one is because you apparently overheard our coven talk, but then this is to your dog because he took a bite out of Albert's harm. I just love the way she says harm.
His harm!
And just like, her like face, like during that whole exchange, because she has this like gleeful, like she's enjoying abusing him in that moment. It's just like she's she getting really off is. On it. Like she's totally. She's so good in this. I hate her, but I just like I love to hate her, you know.
Yeah, she's terrifying. Yeah. And so good. Like I mean, I wondered for a while. Because so many people are dubbed, I was wondering if she was dubbed. Because she has a distinctly European look to her. Like, she fits in Germany. Like, you know, even though I'm perceiving Italy.
Well, she's got that, the bun, like, tightly woven back. And you know, just stretching her smile back, like, even more.
Yes, a lot of teeth. A lot of teeth. Incredible teeth. And those, like, those almost, like, stainless steel kind of, like, quality behind her eyes. Like, even when she is grinning at you, like, you just kind of feel cold. Like, I'm sure in her life she was a warm, wonderful person. But she can access that severity, the aforementioned severity, like, so incredible. She's got – it works so well on – but – and it does make me really, really kind of loathe her as a character. But I still love watching her. Like, I would never – even kind of like watching her get it in the end, like I don't derive any pleasure from it, you know, when she's like, when they're all clutching their throats and everything. Oh, because that's another thing I wanted to mention. I can respect within the body of the movie, like the fact that the coven are the heavies and Susie and anyone who helps Susie is, you know, like a hero, or at least is a benevolent force who's ushering the hero forward.
Yeah.
I can accept all of that. That said, at the end of the day, sometimes I just kind of feel like I'm watching two men, distinctly Dr. Mandel and Professor Milius, for lack of a better term, mansplain to Susie what's happening. And
Well, she has this moment, sorry, that where, because. Yeah, first Udo Kier is like telling her about Helena Marcos, and then the other guy comes up, and I think she asks something about Helena Marcos, and he's just like, yeah, she was a very, very powerful witch, like here in Freiburg. Like, did you know that? And she kind of like, she's like, yes. Like she does this like this like blink and like sigh, like, yes, let's move it along.
Yes, tell me something I don't know. Come on. Stop treating me like I'm an idiot. Yeah. I'm not a child. But because also that's another thing. It's just, I recognize like what the structure of the movie is. I respect it. I can watch it that way. But every now and then there's something even about the fact that like when the directress, you know, when Marcos is hurt, the fact that it affects all of them, that's empathic.
Yeah.
Like that means you are connected to something outside of yourself. Granted, it's completely isolated. And even though Anomilia says it's about amassing great personal wealth at the expense of others, and obviously at a great expense, like, you know, you're killing quote unquote innocent people. But or just bystanders, let's put it that way. Or people
are they innocent though?
Be in the wrong place at the wrong time. I don't know if they're innocent, but people who just happen to be in the wrong place at the wrong time. Let's put it.
They're associated with evil, and here's the thing: because the professor even mansplains this, that he says that these witches derive their power from doing evil things to people. Like they're not good witch. Like they're not like. Powerful because they're like cultivating all of this like magic and whatnot for just like for like, you know, flowers and lollipops and like and sunshine kisses.
For cultivating life.
You know, they're literally like they're toxic. Like they're doing bad things because the more evil they are, the more power they get. So I don't think that anyone is innocent that's part of this coven.
No. I didn't call that. I don't mean them innocent. I mean like the people who they attack. Like that I was used. That's why I said quote unquote innocent bystanders. Like I'm not calling the coven innocent. I'm calling. Oh.
Well, you were speaking about like even, like them like getting affected by Marcos getting beheaded.
Because it's the fact that there is some kind of like connection, the fact that there is something that they all share, like that is something undeniable. Granted, it could be a full-on subservient, you know, like or submissive position you must put yourself in order to amass whatever little power they decide you have. I don't really know what the structure is. That's another thing that this movie doesn't fill in the blanks, and I feel like, you know, the remake really goes into the politics of, like, you know, the way the coven works, and I appreciate that. But I appreciate the ambiguity here. Because all it does is kind of like make me think, I agree with you, they are a destructive force for sure. But the fact that they don't seem to be only out for themselves. I don't feel like they would willingly sacrifice one of their own just to kind of like keep their mouths clean, as it were, just to kind of keep, you know, just like, oh, we can't have suspicion on us, so let's just throw one of our own under the bus. It does feel like there is some kind of familial bond, which makes them more interesting, more dimensional than merely like a coven of evil women, you know, like I feel like there's more there, or at least an implication that there's more to them than just kind of like, hey, we're evil. It's like, no, they're a family, I believe, you know, and they do kind of operate. They just move. I mean, we kind of went into this in our Buffy season 3 discussion. I won't create any spoilers or anything, but just in terms of like what one bond can be built upon if it's, you know, fighting for good, and what another bond can be built upon if you both just kind of share the same agenda or the same end game, and you find connection through that. You find like an actual familial bond with it. And I feel like the coven of Suspiria deserve, you know, at least that kind of status granted to them from me, a lowly mortal moviegoer.
I mean, you're basing a lot of this off of assumption as well, because there's
totally.
This is, you know, but I know that you're the headcanon queen.
Queen.
Whichever King whichever King title King you prefer. But I mean, I agree to an extent. I mean, we don't see, like, there could be. I think that maybe the underlings, like, they're probably more like a family, but I think that, like, if Marcos was just kind of like, oh, I need to, like, get the fuck out of here, she would, like, have no problem getting rid of her disciples and then starting a new coven somewhere else if need be.
Okay.
Yeah. I think the head, if anything, the head is like, the head will cannibalize the rest of the body just to save itself.
I mean, I can't argue with that, because I don't feel like there's any real evidence either way, but I that's why I can't argue with it. I'm just kind of like, okay, that makes sense. If that happened, it would make sense. But also, if something happened to one of her own and she started just kind of shrieking, my baby, that would make sense to me too. So,
well, I think she'd probably be annoyed, because it's just like those were my babies, but it's not gonna affect her, because you can go and kill like a Madam Stank and a Miss Tanner, but that ain't gonna affect the snake. Like, you gotta cut off the snake's head, like this was mansplained to Susie. To be fair, she did pose the question. She's like, might there exist a guild of coven or guild of witches? And he's like, I think you mean coven, or like the correct term is coven.
I want us to do a dramatic reading of this movie.
We'll do a dramatic reading for something at some point, but
okay. Patreon.
We'll have, no, we can do it on the regular podcast, but we have to, like, prepare for it. We have to know what's coming.
We could do like a greatest hits of Suspiria. Yeah, like some great scenes, some great exchanges.
I think that,
but I call Susie.
Okay, whatever.
Madam, why Blank,
you just I do do like a one man show of you just doing all the voices?
No, but I like your Professor Milius.
I don't even remember. Is that what he sounded like? I just was making up a random voice. I'd rather do a reading.
I don't care. It entertained the shit.
I'd rather do a reading of like a child's play or something, but I don't.
Oh, that'd be fun.
I don't know who you would.
We should do, play. Oh, Bride of Chucky. I'll be Tiffany and you be Chucky.
Okay, when we get to it.
Yay! Oh, good. Something to look forward to.
You do have the Tiffany down. That I'll give you that.
Oh, thank you. I'm not going to do it right now. No, I don't want to spoil anything. But you brought up the reptilian kind of like motif at play. And another one that I noticed, I think the last time that I watched this was just a design that stood out to me of the doors that Susie moves to, and in particular, like as she's navigating her way and the light is on her and she sees Albert and the cook. I don't even remember if she has a name.
I think it's just the cook, like the ogre-esque women. Dear. She's like sneaking by because they're like chopping up something in there, and she's like runs out with like the cleaver or like the butcher knife, and she's like, "Who's there?
Carving knife,
who's there?" like Jesus Christ! Like, is that you're in a school for crying out loud? Is that how you? Like...
But everybody's under a spell. Nobody's supposed to be up. So
well, they're not even there. They're all at like a show because.
Yeah, exactly. So no one's going to be there.
Miss Tanner procured tickets for everyone.
Yes.
It's like, well, why wasn't I invited? Or it's like, why wasn't I invited? It's just like, I don't know. I forget what the exchange was. Like, she was
cartoon snail.
She was really, no, that was like the most annoyed that Susie was in the movie when she's just like, well, why wasn't I told? Why wasn't I invited? And just like, did she say anything?
Like, oh my god. Anyway, the thing that I noticed in that hallway, yeah. And particularly like also in like Susie and Sarah's bedrooms and everything, is just like this incredible graphic shapes of the doors. There's like French doors that have like windows in them.
Oh, the transom and also window.
And above the threshold of Susie and Sarah's room, there's also just these three kind of shapes that have little windows that, you know, the lights glow when Susie is making her escape and everything, or you know, her escape to the climax.
Yeah,
and they just kind of looked incredibly like insect-like to me, and just kind of created this atmosphere of. Because I think insects, I always go to predators for some reason. Like insects are predatory and they kind of like prey on, not their own, I mean like they prey on each other, other insects. But there's something so incredibly kind of like almost natural and food chainy about the way they kill. Like it's almost like business as usual. It's not a crime of passion. It's just kind of like what they do, which also on the other side of like the witches here, I made an argument for maybe their humanity, but the kind of like insect shapes I was reading or insect markings I was reading in like their hallways and everything like that made them seem, predatory in a very, kind of like disconnected way. Like it's not about gleaning any particular joy really from the murder, even though there is some passion in Joan Bennett when, you know, her delivery of like, I want the girl dead, blah, 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 and all that stuff. She's just letting off some steam. But I feel like it's not from a place of actual, you know, visceral hatred or anger. I feel like it's much more just kind of their nature. Like, this is just what witches of their ilk do. And therefore, it feels even more threatening to me because it's just like waiting. If you're a fly and you get caught in a spider web, fuck, this is what happens. Now the spider's going to come kill me, not because it hates me, but because I'm prey. And I just kind of feel like that's what those girls are to them, especially the curious one.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you have a knack for reading into things a lot more than most people. And I'm always amazed by the little connections you make because I don't get any of that myself. I just see like a very, like I just opulence is really like how
yes.
I would describe this. And just like this very Art Deco design to everything that like every area does have that distinct look, like you were mentioning the velvet wallpaper. And then you have like sort of like once she gets in like through that big like Escher, the Escher-esque mural with the irises with like the secret switch, right, and the door that opens, and there's like a hallway with this like gold inscription. Yes. There's like Hebrew written all along, and there's like these sheer curtains that she's hiding behind from Pablos. And still, like, through this entire thing, like, I don't know where anything is in relation to anything. It's just like she's moving from one area to the next, and it's just like,
yeah,
how do you know where to go? Like, what's like like how you where and she eventually
designed,
like,
designed this place.
Yeah. And then eventually like ends up in the master bedroom, the directress's bedroom, and which is like probably the most opulent of all the rooms. Because that peacock, I want that peacock. I like,
don't we all?
I need that, like, I don't care how gaudy it is. I just want that, like, in my living room.
I wonder if there's something you can find on Etsy or something like that.
A while ago, I was looking, because I actually did, at one point in my life, I decided for myself, like, I need to have my apartment decor be Suspiria. So I, like, literally, like, did all this, like, wild shit. I had, like, doors painted in, like, a glossy black, and put like white painted like ornate things around it to look like in the movie. And I'm just like, oh, you know, if you didn't know I was gay then, but I literally like looked online, because I was just like, I want like a peacock thing, like that sort of like peacock thing. Like I wanted a peacock motif. And yeah, I couldn't find anything like that. But I had like the light bulbs. Like I would get like, I had like a closet that had a light in it. So I'd like put a green light bulb in there, and you'd have like blue and like red and that. And it was like pretty crazy. And people were like, you're going to get like really nauseated. Like this is going to be too much. And I'm like, no, it's going to be fine. And it was a lot. I'll say, yeah, I don't know how long live it lasted.
In, I mean,
yeah,
it's one thing to shoot on a stage like that. It's another thing to live in a venue that's entirely decked out.
Like, I mean, just imagine if I had like the velvet wallpaper. Like, it was pretty crazy.
But I feel like that it's funny because also even I think my favorite is the staircase in that blue entryway.
Yeah. That's got like sort of like the snake motif to it. Like the golden,
or even the like, I thought like tubes also, almost kind of like tubes that like cocoons might like hatch in or something. I mean, again, it's just it's gross. But at the same time, it's almost, you know, like behold, and it reminds me. The only thing, every time I look at it, it reminds me of an old movie called Anti-Mame, where Rosalind Russell's character Mame Dennis lives in this Park Avenue apartment, and she has a staircase that is exactly that staircase, except she's always redesigning it. It gets redone three or four times throughout the movie, and you know that as the years are passing, it's gotten redone even more, and it just looks like, oh, that's that stage when Mame was going through her Argento phase, like you know.
I'm getting more of Ab Fab and how like Eddie has to like like every season, it's like a new kitchen.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. Yes. That is
for anyone who gets the reference. Yeah.
Yes. Either one of them. Kudos to you and welcome. And if you don't watch Anti-Mame, watch Ab Fab. What are you doing with your life? but without judgment, with love.
Yeah.
Also, another thing, I like the goblin track that seems to kind of like live on in most people's eyes is obviously like the chimey opening la 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 one.
Yeah.
And rightfully so. I mean, it's whatever the sonic equivalent for iconic is.
Yeah.
It's Isonic. And
I've got the album. Right here, right behind me for anyone who's watching.
And as used as it is in the movie, I don't feel like it's overused at all. I absolutely adore it every time it's cued.
And it's the same seven like notes like over and over again.
And I thought I heard, I had one of the commentaries for my Blue running while I was setting all this up earlier. And I thought I heard, because you know, when you're doing things, you kind of half hear things. But I thought I heard the historian say that it was a play on, yes, Jesus loves me, the Bible tells me so, which I never supposed before. And I was just kind of like, that's creepy as fuck. like, I mean... I was raised Catholic.
Are they just making like that up, or did they actually like talk to Claudio Simonetti and get that?
I mean, if it's a historian, they don't, they're not known for making things up. So, yeah. I mean, again, it's probably a variation on it. Like, it's not full on like that song, but just kind of like a variation.
Because I was going to say, if that's like what a historian is, then I would just like be like a self-proclaimed scream historian at this point.
You can be. I mean, until somebody says, no, you're not. But
they do.
You are. Find out what the what the requirements are to be to dub yourself a historian.
Yeah. Like,
there must be some some badge you can carry.
Yeah. If I have to pay money for it though, like that's a bit much. Because I feel like that's
probably
you don't need any like prerequisites or qualifications. You just have to pay like a large fee to some sort of society, and they're just like, you are now a historian in this one particular subject, and your name will be in a book if they look you up.
Buy a ghost face badge off Etsy, you know, a ghost face
badge. You and your Etsy.
I don't know why it's occurring. It's the holiday season, and it's where a lot of people want their gift cards from. Don't ask me; it's in my head.
Okay.
But the other thing that I think of when I watch this is what I call the Footloose track. I don't know what it's called, what its proper name is. You'd probably
like the,
but it's just Footloose, the one with all the clanging.
Footloose.
Kick yeah, off just your because Sunday I always make sure about like the clanging in the beginning. The dun, 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 dun. And it's not that beat at all, but it sounds like a similar like kind of like instrument that they're clanging on.
I don't,
they are clanging.
You know, when you even... you make like connections to music that I have like I don't even know where you get, like, because you did the Pat Benatar
totally.
Love is a Battlefield is like the Child's Play thing, and it's actually I had to like listen. I'm just like, okay, it's there, but like, how did you see that? How did you hear that? I should say, like, chime, chime, and now we're like Suspiria, like Goblin and Footloose, like that. Someone needs to, like, someone who's listening, who's like savvy with like sound mixing and all that, put a track together of Footloose and Suspiria, and do one for Child's Play one theme and Pat Benatar, Love is a Battlefield as well. Just see if it works. Maybe you'll get a hit on your hands.
Oh my God, but that's all I want for Christmas now.
Yeah.
That's fun. So, I mean, I don't know how much more I have to say about this movie outside of, I mean, is there anything we haven't covered yet?
We know, like always, we probably... we'll remember it after the fact, but I was feeling that we're probably good to get to the next stage of the podcast. So let's do it. Let's get to the cherry picker. It's not like we killed people on purpose. Okay, first order of business: we need a cherry on top. No, because I mean, I know where you mean, but I don't know. What do you mean?
I mean, it wouldn't be the same movie for me without Jessica Harper as Susie Banyan, character or actress. So I want whatever she is. I forget. I don't even remember. Do we assign it to the character or to the actor?
The character.
Okay, the character.
I don't know though. Well, because you, I mean, you went on about how she's so passive through most of the movie,
and yet it doesn't detract from my enjoyment of her occupying screen time. that's a feat.
Okay, whatever. I don't care enough that I would argue this, because I don't really have anyone. Like, the thing is, like, everyone, like, there's really like no person that I would want to like be the cherry on top and to not be the cherry on top. So If she, she's the character that represents the movie, like she's the final girl, so that's fair. We'll go with her.
Yeah, for her to be as ineffective as she is until like kind of like the last inning, and then for her to come through in the stretch, but
sure,
and for me not to be annoyed by that. Any other final girl in any other movie, I'd probably be annoyed at it, but I'm not. So yeah, there you go. Love you, Jessica Harper. Call me.
Okay, so last week we asked you who deserves to die the most in Evil Dead 2. I nominated Professor Ed Gettley. You nominated Jake. Across Patreon, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube, not a lot of people showed up for this one. And we'll get to that in a second. But it was 161 for Gettley versus 374 for Jake. So you won that round, good sir.
Thanks, guys.
And yeah, what I wanted to say is that, well, because like this, we record these episodes a week in advance. So like the Evil Dead 2 episode just released today. And I just noticed like the algorithm, like the YouTube algorithm, like this episode underperformed. Even like the regular like audio podcast got fewer downloads. So I was just like we had this conversation earlier because I'm just like, is Evil Dead just like, and what did I say? It was like an overhyped franchise.
It's just like
people talk about it and how great it is, but do people actually like it that much or watch it? Because even the first episode that we did, like the first Evil Dead, that one like underperformed as well as like compared to most of our other episodes. So I don't know. I just feel like maybe it's just people don't like Evil Dead.
Or maybe 'tis the season. Like it got released, like, you know, the last week of November.
There is an Evil Dead. There's a new Evil Dead movie coming out. I'm determined I want to hear from people what your take on it is, because I'm aghast.
On the phenomenon of the franchise and its effect on our our downloads.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Anyway, let's hear what people had to say. And again, there's very few votes, very few comments for this particular movie, which I is so surprising to me because this is such a great, like we said, like this is probably the funniest horror movie ever. It's one of my favorites, but
everybody was decorating for the holidays.
Okay, it's making up excuses. Michael Begley says, as useless as Ed is, I'm sure he's not talking about you. No. Jake put the group at danger so many times by being selfish and a dumbass, even if his intentions are somewhat only misguided because he's scared for Bobby Joe. I mean, come on. He throws the Necronomicon pages into the cellar and gets himself stabbed on accident. Sorry, Jake, but you're writing your own death certificate here. P.S. This is one of my favorite horror movies. I'm so glad you guys are covering it. Thank you for providing us with a great podcast for horror lovers. You guys have quickly become one of my favorite podcast duos out there. Keep doing what you're doing. Love from Glasgow, Scotland.
Oh my gosh. Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
And just after we're saying like, why?
Who didn't show
up. Why do people not love Evil Dead 2? Rebecca.
Maybe the masses. It's just not for the masses, maybe. Maybe it's more of a niche thing and the passion.
Maybe. Rebecca Unbound Mallard. Ed, but only because good old reliable Jake from Evil Dead the Musical slaps hard.
Oh, I still have to watch it. Somebody downloaded or uploaded a bootleg of the musical on YouTube in its entirety, and I haven't watched it yet.
Isn't it like the first like three rows or something gets doused in blood?
I don't even know. I've never exposed myself to anything, not even the cast album. Yeah. So I need to watch it, and I need to make it part of my diet.
Jeremy Huff. While they were both just deadite fodder, Jake is higher on my annoyance meter. So yeah, LOL.
Cool. Thanks.
Stabane Ellen. I kind of feel bad for Jake for being dumb while the professor was smart and annoyed me. That's hilarious. Do we have a vocal minority here? My Chucky Jordy says, Ed gave me creepy vibes as a kid, just didn't like him.
Wow.
Mr. Check Yourself, definitely Jake. And Heather Utterback says, Jake, him screaming for Bobby Joe like a dumbass always annoyed me, and I always thought he was way too old for Bobby Joe. Creepy AF.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. Did I even bring that up? I don't think I did, but I agree. I concur. So, all right. Thanks, guys. Thanks for showing up.
Yeah.
Those who showed up. So I get first pick. Okay. I'm going to go kind of on the heels. It's nice that the, that one person who was kind of put off by Ed, even though you didn't vote for mine, I like the way you think, because I'm put off by someone who we haven't really talked that much about in this movie in a huge way. And it's Albert. There's something about his Little Lord Fauntleroy fashion sense, and plus just like the blonde hair, the pale skin, the blue eyes, you're giving me Village of the Damned, Children of the Corn, all of the above. And the fact that he just, I don't like him when he's serious because he looks evil, but when he smiles, he looks evil too. There's that one point where
the light, yeah,
Susie's, yeah, kind of hallucinating, and you just see the light pass and he's grinning, and it's not good.
Yeah.
It is not. There's nothing that child can do that won't make me angry or upset or uncomfortable. He is an albino Eddie Munster, and I'm not about it. Sorry to any albinos listening. It's not about that. It's just about the vibe off the kid.
Yeah.
You know, I'm an aesthetic based.
Also, I mean, dogs know. Dogs. They know exactly. A bitch when they see one. And
the way they walk up to the dog, like the dog's not in their way.
Yeah.
They like are marching up, him and the cook are like walking up to the dog in a way that I'm like, this is all part of the plan. This is all something to incriminate Daniel. I mean, it's all, I am such a conspiracy theorist when it comes to this movie.
Yeah.
Even about the people committing the crimes, I'm still a conspiracy, like, but they're a family. Anyway.
Yeah.
But
he's also
by far the creepiest thing about the movie.
He's also like the most useless hench person of the, like, he doesn't do anything.
He's a pawn.
Yeah.
He's a pawn. He's a creepy.
He just
pawn.
Go check on the so go no... check on how the bedding is coming along. You know, he doesn't.
He's just there. I'd probably cosplay as him in a heartbeat.
Yeah.
I've never been blonde before, so why not?
Yeah.
So that's my choice, Albert.
Next yeah. Time. Okay. Well, you picked my first choice, so I'm gonna go on
sorry.
It's okay. That's how the game works. I'm going to fall back on, you know, I've already talked about her ad nauseum, but I'm going to go with Madame Stank on this one because, you know, like you said, like we both discussed, like, you know, there's evil and there's presenting yourself as, you know, being a bitch, like, you know, maybe Miss Tanner does. Because she even, like, has that, like, a side moment, Miss Tanner, when she's like, I see when you make up your mind, you stick to it. Like, my respect to that or whatever. So it's like, she's a bitch who's not afraid, you know, even if she's, like, grinning at Daniel as she's, like, pushing him, this poor blind man, out the door. You know, she owns that. Madame Stank is in there and she's just fucking, like being prim and proper and being like, yeah, like lying to your face and being like, oh, everything's good. Like, oh, maybe I should, like, you know, just acquiescing to what you say and placating you to think like, oh, let me pass this information along to the detectives. I wonder if she even dialed that fucking phone. Like, that's how fake I think she is. She probably just like pretended to like call and she was like, oh, let me speak to like detective whoever. And yeah. And then we see her true colors. Stank. Yeah, Madame Stank is the one. And she's just super pretentious. I don't like her. I don't like her vibe.
Oh, see, she so incredibly like just reminds me of Elizabeth Collins from Dark Shadows. It's the role that Michelle Pfeiffer played in the movie to perfection. People criticize Michelle Pfeiffer like she was so wooden. I'm like, that's what Elizabeth Bennett did. Oh, not Elizabeth Bennett. Joan Bennett. Elizabeth Collins. I'm mixing them up.
Yeah, you said Joan Collins at first.
Did I say Joan Collins? Yeah, oh my gosh, I'm tired. I need to stop talking. But Okay, but that's what I see. That's why I didn't pick her. But we'll see. We'll see.
We'll see. We'll see. Vote your heart. Vote your conscience. You can vote Albert, or you can vote Madam Blank.
Stank.
Stank. And
you say blank the same way I say stank.
Yeah. Or do Madam Stonk.
Madam Stonk.
She's like proper.
Maybe that's our compromise. Stonk. Yeah.
But you can vote on Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. You can also vote on Patreon if you are supporting us there. I would like to welcome a new Patreon supporter, however, so give it up to Jeremy Huff.
Yay!
Hello, welcome aboard.
Hi, Jeremy, thank you.
And also thank you to Andre Felix, the Cherry Picker editor.
Of course.
If you would like to follow us on social media, the official Instagram account is at the Cherry Picker Pod. If you're brand new to the Cherry Picker and you are watching us on YouTube, you can find the RSS feed link in the descriptions down below and listen to us at your listening pleasure. Or if you are listening to us, go to YouTube at the Cherry Picker, watch us there. You can see our faces and subscribe to us. We're also on Twitter. But where where can they find you individually?
Not on Twitter. I still haven't recovered my account. But you can go to Instagram at Edward is Truth is the handle, all one word. And you can go to YouTube. Edward is Truth is the handle there. And it's all one word. And I feel like I was on something else that I should like tell people about, but I don't remember. Oh, I mean, I started that. What's that? I don't even remember the name.
The new one?
You review movies. Letterboxd, that thing. I've reviewed one movie, but I did write it, and I'm proud of what I wrote. Okay. So check it out if you want to. And I think I'm Edward is Truth on that, too. Can't verify that. DM me if you can't find me.
Very nice. Very nice. Very nice.
How about you?
You can find me on YouTube, Zach Cherry, Z-A-C-K. Yes, I'm Canadian. And also on Instagram, at Retro Bitch Face, all one word. Twitter, Zach Cherry 8, and was there something else?
Yeah.
No, that's all the social media. I guess there's Letterboxd too. I don't know what the thing. There's links if you go to my YouTube page. You know, they're in the corner. They're in like the banner thing there.
Yeah.
Back to Patreon. If you do support me on my Patreon account, which is also the support of this Cherry Picker podcast, you will get bonus episodes of the podcast that we do every month that starts at the Freddy Krueger tier. So this last month, we covered Buffy season 3, as Edward had already mentioned earlier in the episode. And if you do subscribe to that, you'll be able to hear our episodes for seasons 1 and season 2 as well. But this month for the Cherry Picker After Dark, we are doing a podcast on Jawbreaker.
Yay, which the breaker
we love, which is referenced in every episode as we do the transition to to the Cherry Picker. And it's kind of like our slogan, really, or whatever you want to call it. Yeah, it's like where we kill people, but not really. you can subscribe and you can get bonus episodes. Or if you even subscribe at the entry level pinhead tier, you will get early access to all of these episodes as they're released weekly. Those come out 4 to 5 days earlier before they're released. So if you need a little bit more Cherry Picker in your life, that's where you'll be able to find it. Otherwise, what have we got going on next week, Eduardo?
Okay, you didn't brief me on this, so I think I know. Yeah. I think I remember for a change. So is it, but I don't want to like say it's something that it isn't, so I'm just going to dance around it like I do. Is it the one where like inside an oyster you find it's a sequel to not Y and not Z, but okay,
Not a Pearl. Sequel. Not a sequel.
Oh, prequel. Prequel. Sorry, you were miming. I didn't realize.
Let's go back. Yeah.
You're going forward from my vantage point. You're pointing.
Yeah.
In the direction where things go forward instead of. Anyway.
We get it. It's like, Pearl.
Should I wrap it up?
We're doing Pearl. Pearl.
We're doing Pearl.
Anyway, thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. And we will be right back.